This is Andy Bobick, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the most current December 2024 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with an article about Supertramp making their album, The Crime of the Century. And after 15 years, The Cure have a new album out. And a classic album review of MTV Unplugged by Nirvana. And I begin with the article about Supertramp titled The Art of the Steel. Take a songwriting odd couple, Ziggy's producer, and a plate of hash cakes. 50 years ago, Supertramp's Crime of the Century came from nowhere to rank among the decade's biggest albums. But it wasn't just the fans or critics who were amazed. When we heard it, our minds were blown, the band tells Phil Alexander. I am as broad-minded as the next man, but I was surprised to see bare breast on the cover of Supertramp's indelibly stamped album. I was also astounded to see contraceptives on the cover of Birth Control's album. Are album covers going to get more obscene? If so, something should be done about it. So began a letter from outraged reader C. Allen of Tooting that appeared in the issue of British weekly music paper Melody Maker, published on July 1st, 1971. The week previously, Supertramp had released their second album, its sleeve featuring the bare, heavily tattooed chest of one Marion Haller, and receiving, as Sounds newspaper pointed out, a noticeably cooler reception than the band's self-titled debut a year earlier. Solicitous artwork aside, the 10 tracks on offer sounded uneven. The quasi-quo boogie of opener, Your Papa Don't Mind, at odds with the 7-minute-plus album closer, the acoustic, flute-driven Aries. As 1973 dawned, after a 2-year run of bad shows, including an ill-advised Scandinavian jaunt, which left them temporarily stranded, and minimal record sales, the band's principal songwriters, Rick Davies and Roger Hodgkin, had a decision to make. Rick and I did sit down and say, let's call it quits. And we did, Hodgkin told this writer in 2014. For 2 days, I was thinking of going to India. In the end, the 23-year-old opted for a less mystical adventure, signing up to play guitar in Chuck Berry's pickup band for a short run of UK shows. The notoriously temperamental rocker met his new band 20 minutes prior to their first gig in Manchester, ordering them to follow his lead. Halfway through the gig, he spotted the shy, retiring Hodgkin loitering toward the back of the stage. Go out front and earn your money. Take this solo, he barked. I trotted out, terrified, into the middle of the stage and did a solo and then slid back into the shadows of my amp. Hodgkin recalled, Chuck Berry winked at me. It was quite an experience. 18 months later, in an unlikely turnaround, a reconstituted Supertramp would release Crime of the Century, an album that matched the harmonic power of Turn of the Decade Beach Boys to the musical ambition and eccentric textures of British progressive rock. A cousin to contemporary releases by Elton John, Caribou, and Fleetwood Mac, heroes are hard to find, but which eclipsed both creatively and commercially. Photographs of Supertramp from 1974 show an almost bookish set of individuals seemingly unprepared for the stardom about to overtake them. As they embarked on a run of hits that would peak in 1979 with the U.S. number one in Breakfast in America and end in 1983 with Hodgkin's shock departure from the group. I don't think we had a goal in mind when we started the album, says Hodgkin, reflecting on the album's impact, and we didn't realize what we'd created at first either. The ad that Rick Davies placed in the classified section of Melody Maker on August 9, 1969, was unflowery, offering a genuine opportunity for good musicians. Roger Hodgkin called the listed number and secured an audition for the mystery band. His initial impressions weren't good, but when Davies and Hodgkins headed to the pub, they enjoyed each other's company, kicking off a relationship of contrast. An arc realist, Richard Davies was born into a working-class family on July 22, 1944, in Swindon, Wiltshire. Inspired by percussionist Gene Krupa and boogie player Mead Lux Lewis, he swapped his early passion for drums for the piano before studying art at Swindon College. By the time he met Hodgkin, he'd already played in a rock and roll band, his own blues band, Rick's Blues, with the young Gilbert O'Sullivan, and The Joint, a soul-inspired combo based in Europe, who were funded by a Dutch millionaire. According to Davies himself, he was driven by fear of ending up back in a factory. Near the other end of Britain's social scale, Portsmouth-born Charles Roger Pomfret Hodgkin, 6 years Davies Jr., grew up in Oxford and was packed off to boarding school at an early age, first to Woodcote House in Surrey and then Stowe School in Buckinghamshire. Old boys, Prince Rainier of Monaco, David Nevin, and Richard Branson. I was a sensitive boy thrust into the middle of nowhere with 600 other boys, he recalled of his time at Stowe, describing his education as being akin to living through the end of the Victorian era. Leaving school, he joined psych outfit People Like Us, cutting a 7-inch for Decca before recording a second single with the equally short-lived Argosy, a whimsical outfit that featured the young Reginald Dwight, a.k.a. Elton John, on piano, guitarist Kalib Quay, and drummer Nigel Olsen. Music, according to Roger, was always a quest. A quest for what? Happiness, love, and peace. That first music Davies and Hodgkins made together was under the name Daddy, before switching to Supertramp, taken from Welsh poet W.H. Davies' 1908 The Autobiography of a Supertramp. There's YouTube footage of them playing in Germany in early 1970 as a four-piece with Hodgkin on bass, blasting out a 10-minute blues rock version of Dylan's All Along the Watchtower. Originally, lyrical duties were entrusted to guitarist Richard Palmer, who also shared lead vocals on two of the tracks on Supertramp. It was his departure in December 1970 that forced Davies and Hodgkin to assume full responsibility for the band's output, both lyrically and with a shift in sound to a more piano-based approach. The pair's differing personalities were already evident, but both had begun to view music as more than just a way of scratching a living. "Rick and I were very different," Hodgkin admits, "and there was a huge difference in our influences. But we were also both very alike because we were very dysfunctional. We looked to music to feel good about ourselves." If the first two Supertramp LPs suggested a band in search of a sound, the duo's new set of songs signified a new found cohesion. Before Hodgkin's brief spell with Chuck Berry, Davies had already written the strident Bloody Well Right. Hodgkin had had Dreamer since he was 19. "It exploded out of me the day at my mother's house at Wantage," he told me. Another song, School, routined extensively with Davies, was a scathing attack on the alienation he felt as a result of his elite education. "I had a lot of wounds to heal," he noted. Here's a little bit of the song Dreamer by Supertramp. What they needed were musicians who could do justice to these songs. First through the door was 22-year-old Glaswegian bass player Doogie Thompson, formerly of the Alan Brown Set. The original group had collapsed, and there was a sense of the band being in disarray, recalls Thompson today. "When I first met Rick and Roger, they were a little disheveled, shall we say." As auditions continued at the Pied Bull Pub in Ishington, North London, Thompson proved to be a galvanizing influence. He was never officially asked to join Supertramp, but such was his pragmatism. Hodgkin handed him a bag of receipts. "You can take care of the business," is what he said. Smiles Thompson. And for the majority of the band's career, the bassist would do just that. For the new recruits, Supertramp's songs in Waiting were the convincers. Roger played me a version of Breakfast in America on pump organ when we were at his mom's house, and that was it, says Thompson. California-born drummer Bob C. Benberg, N.E. Snenberg, a name he would return to in the latter part of the band's career, then a member of pub rock combo Bees Make Honey, popped by the band's shared house in Holland Villas Road and heard another batch of unreleased songs. Hodgkin's If Everyone Was Listening and Davy's Asylum among them. Here's a little bit of the song If Everyone Was Listening by Supertramp.
The stage is in darkness and clear. We're raising the curtain, and no one's quite certain whose play it is.
How long?
If only we had listened then. If we'd known just how right we were going to be. For we dreamed a lot, and we schemed a lot, and we tried to sing of love before the stage fell apart. Oh.
I knew then that there was something special there, says the drummer, who shared the songwriter's love of Traffic, Spooky Tooth, and Procol Harum. I liked that stuff, and I knew I could add the American feel of someone like Levon Helm from the band, different from the feel that you got from British drummers at the time, a sense of power. For the final piece of the sonic puzzle, Benberg had hoped to enlist the service of his brother-in-law, Scott Gorham, later of Thin Lizzy, and the guitarist flew over from L.A. to audition. His arrival, however, coincided with Thompson's call to add an old friend he knew from the Alan Brown set, sax and reeds player John Helliwell. I went to meet the band at Manfred Mann's studio, where they were rehearsing. Helliwell recalls, "Rick was there wearing an anorak, and I thought, what a strange-looking guy. Rogers was there too, and the first time he played me was From Now On, destined for 1977's Even in the Quietest Moments. I thought, whoa." And here's a little bit of that song, From Now On, from Supertramp.
in the same old place. The same old face is always watching me. Who knows how long I'll have to stay? Could be 100 years of sweat and tears, the rate that I get paid. I slowly drift away from all the dull routine that's with me every day. A fantasy will come to me.
I'd been used to playing with jobbing musicians that just got on with it, but these guys were different. Continues the Yorkshire-born jazzer. They were experimenting and changing things as they went along until they felt it was right. And there was also the contrast between Rick and Roger, which I thought was really interesting. By the autumn of 1973, the impact of this latest batch of songs was already evident on their new bandmates. The questions now was whether, after the polite failure of their last two albums, anyone at their label, A&M, would give a damn. Thompson decided that he and Hodgkin should appeal to label boss Derek Green face to face. Green was surprised to see them, but introduced the pair to A&R man Dave Margaretson, an irrepressible Londoner who'd started out as an actor. Margaretson had worked at CBS, where he'd signed Johnny Nash, overseeing his 1972 number one, I Can See Clearly Now. The 26-year-old Bob Marley and a fiery young Irish guitar player named Gary Moore, before being poached by Green to join A&M Q, a familiar pattern. Margaretson heard the band's latest demos and was hooked. All they needed to do now, he felt, was become a proper band. To that end, in November 1973, Margaretson persuaded Supertramp to decamp to Southcombe, a 20-pound-per-week farmhouse in Somerset. Benberg and Helenwell brought their wives, Thompson his wife and daughter. Davies and Hodgkin had yet to start their own families. I felt alone, and so did Rick. So we concentrated on the music, admitted Hodgkin years later. But we had a relentless passion that drove the band. Southcombe would prove to be a hugely positive experience for Supertramp. After a leisurely morning, they'd begin playing mid-afternoon and routine new songs into the night. With their gear set up in the low-ceilinged room next door to the kitchen, the results were captured on a Sony reel-to-reel and constantly fine-tuned. Songwriting and team bonding combined. Hodgkin wrote Hide in Your Shell out Southcombe after every member of the band bar Davies had consumed a plate of hash brownies. The song's juxtaposition of the composer's love-led idealism against the scramble of real life outside encapsulated Southcombe's idyllic retreat. It was a place where we learnt to see each other as we really were, says Benberg, and we learnt the dynamics of the band as people and as players. Conscious that it had been over 2 years since the band's last release, Margenson suggested they record and release a new song. As a Sign of Life. Land Ho, hurriedly produced by the A&R and the band, was released on March the 1st, 1974. Failed to chart. Undeterred, Margenson plowed on. His original choice of producer for the single had been Ken Scott, who'd engineered Elton John's last two albums and was fresh from producing Bowie's The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and The Spiders from Mars, and Aladdin Sane. Yet, despite Margenson's ebullience, Scott remained resistant to the idea of working with Supertramp. "I didn't really like the demos at all," he admits. "They just seemed to be half-baked, half an idea at a time. But Jack Nelson, who ran the producers at Trident Studios where I worked, told me A&M really wanted me to do the band. In the end, I went to see them at a showcase with Jack. When we left, Jack said, 'You're right. Don't bother doing them.' I turned around and said, 'Are you kidding? They're incredible.'" On February the 4th, 1974, Scott traveled down to Somerset to put the band through their paces. Further impressed with what he heard, 5 days later, he took them back to Trident. The music was really ambitious, and they really wanted to push things. "So that's what we did in the studio," he says. "The band were just open to any suggestions about how to make the record sound different. I used all the experience that I had from some pretty intense sessions with the Beatles, and we tried everything we could think of." "Ken was a good mentor," says Hodgkins. "He encouraged us to experiment with everything from saws being bowed to glasses being played with a finger. He gave us the ultimate opportunity to create." For Scott, the contrasting songwriters put him in mind of some of his more celebrated clients. "The partnership between Rick and Roger reminded me of Lennon and McCartney," he says. "Those differing personalities made the music sound the way it did." The average cost of a house in the UK in the summer of 1974 was £9,000. Supertramp had already spent double that before they'd even come close to finishing the album that became Crime of the Century. One factor was Ken Scott's meticulousness. Benberg recalls that it took 3 days for the producer to get the drum sound he wanted. "And that was working almost 10 hours a day," he laughs. The overspend was such that L.A.-based label boss Jerry Moss, the M in A&M, felt the need to pay them a visit. "I panicked totally because we had what amounted to the basic tracks, and that was about it," recalls Scott. "I never really met a head of a record label at that point either, but Jerry came down, heard what we were doing, said, 'That's great,' and left." In the end, Crime took 5 months to record in three London studios, Trident, Ramport, and Scorpio Sound, where it was mixed because Scott was particularly keen on the monitors. But it was time well spent. The considered production decisions justified by the results. From Mick Davies' Earth Roll, Morricone-esque harmonica part that opens School, to the sweeping Richard Hewson's arranged strings that conclude Davies' blue-collar mini-epic Rudy. Crime was full of Breval touches. And here's a little bit of the song, Rudy, by Supertramp. The Dark Side of the Moon, it was an album designed to be listened to in one setting. Although the band couldn't be sure of how well it worked until the very end of the process. Because the mix was manually done, it meant that 10 or 20 second sections were done at a time, says Hodgkin. When we heard it, our minds were blown. Crime's astonishing spatial and sonic qualities were matched with emotional writing that sprang from Hodgkin and Davies, hopes and fears. Never before either of the two had been so well balanced. Davies' earthly baritone married Hodgkin's light tenor to heady effect, and while previously Davies had dominated, each assumed lead duties on four tracks each. When I sat down and listened to the album as a whole, remembers Ken Scott, a man known for his modesty, I thought we'd achieved perfection. By the time Crime was finally released in October 1974, Dave Margensen's, now also Supertramp's manager, had whipped the A&M promotional department into a frenzy. Yet results were initially disappointing. Crime swam in the lower reaches of the UK album chart, peaking at 40 in late November before slipping out entirely. Heading out on tour, they took the fake it till you make it approach. Margensen and the band determined they would only play headline shows in order to present their new music properly. Supertramp's sound man and trusted friend, Russell Pope, would ensure the band's live sound was pristine, complemented by the work of lighting designer Tony Shepherd. We had to create an atmosphere, reflects John Helliwell, who adopted the role of the band's live ringmaster. Due to Davies and Hodgkin's continued reluctance as frontmen. So we also made the decision to present the album itself by playing the first side, then a few older tunes and new tunes that we hadn't recorded yet, before finishing with the entire second side. Town hall and university shows through the end of 1974 beat a drum for Supertramp's new LP, supported by positive live reviews. Sales rallied in late January 1975 and were ignited by the release of Dreamer in February, described by band champion John Peel as a track that should rivet lovers of good music whenever they gather together. Between February and April, Hodgkin's keening anthem was unavoidable on UK radio and peaked at 13 in the UK singles chart on March 8th. The following week, its parent album hit number 4 in time for Supertramp to head off on tour in the US, where Crime would be the first Supertramp LP to crack the top 40. A&M took us to a hotel overlooking Central Park and gave us a suite on the 29th floor or something, recalls Helliwell. We thought, wow, this is fantastic. We embraced it all, and we got to know the cities bit by bit as we played. Then Roger broke his wrist, so we had to cancel, but we decided to stay out there and record our next album. Supertramp's embrace of the U.S. would pave the way for the staggering commercial success of 1979's Breakfast in America, sales of which would top 20 million. And yet, it would also speed the classic lineup's demise with a sapping tour that deepened divisions among the band members. I had the impression that Supertramp was disintegrating, Hodgkin would tell band biographer Abel Fuentes. In those concerts, I felt like an actor performing the same part night after night. We had become slaves to a huge production. In 1983, weary by disputes with Davies over their respective songwriting contributions in Supertramp, Hodgkin announced he was going solo. Over time, the communal spirit of Southcombe had long evaporated. Legal shots had been fired between band members, Hodgkin claiming that while he had allowed Davies to keep the Supertramp name in 1983, he had done so without granting Davies the right to play any of his songs. Another case between band members went to court earlier this year over a 1977 agreement where Davies and Hodgkin had granted a share of songwriting royalties to Helliwell, Sonnenberg, and Thompson. While Davies settled out of court, Hodgkin contest that the arrangement was intended to last in perpetuity. He won the case, but an appeal is pending. Against this backdrop, any kind of anniversary celebration of Crime of the Century by the band seems unlikely. Yet the LP musical impact remains undimmed. Its key themes, tackling what Helliwell describes as the man, education, and governmental issues, sounding even more pertinent in 2024. And beyond that, the record endures as a conversation between two songwriters with contrasting but complementary takes on the world, both at the top of their game. It's an honest autobiographical album, concludes Hodgkin, because we wore our inner sleeves on it. And in the end, I think that's what people identify with. Okay, I'm moving on to the article about The Cure, titled Lonely Planet Boy. Haunted by bereavement and disintegration and disintegration, The Cure's Songs of a Lost World, their first album in 16 years, is finally with us. But what's it all about? And will it be Robert Smith's last, often seen as the soundtrack to an eternally doomy adolescence? Judges Victoria Siegel, The Cure might just be coming of age. There is no blue plaque at the railway in Crawley, no photograph celebrating the most culturally significant moment in the pub's history, the first official gig by The Cure, formerly Easy Cure, in 1978. The band's original drummer, Lowell Tolhurst, has spoken to Old Friend on Crawley Town Council about organizing some kind of commemorative sign at the pub formerly known as The Rocket. "I keep telling him I'd come over and help open it," he laughs from his home in Los Angeles. But the portents aren't good. When Tolhurst and his wife were recently visiting family in Crawley, First Cure bassist Michael Dempsey picked them up from Gatwick and drove them around the old haunts, including the pub. "The first thing the barman said to my wife was, 'You have to take that hat off if you come in here,'" recalls Tolhurst dryly. It was very Crawley. Yet the Rocket has once again become embroidered in The Cure's epic story. On September the 13th, the dark poster appeared outside reading Songs of a Lost World and a date, January 11th, 2024. A mail drop to fans of similarly embossed postcards followed, 16 years after the release of 4/13 Dream. It seemed as if The Cure's long-promised 14th album was becoming a reality, a moment even the most ardent keepers of the faith had started to doubt would happen. On social media, it was pointed out generations of fans had never experienced the real-time release of a new Cure album. Some of the kids wearing Boys Don't Cry t-shirts to the 2023 shows weren't even born. Listening to Songs of a Lost World, it's clear why The Cure launched it at their point of origin. It's a record about endings, about loss and grief, about the compromises and confessions that cling to a person as they move through their lives, warping and distorting their original intentions. There is a real poignancy in looking back to a time and place where life was still a clean slate, before you find yourself, as Smith does on the closing track, End Song, looking up at the sky and wondering when you've gone. And here's some of that song, End Song, from the band The Cure. Maybe it does matter if we die after all. When these songs first emerged on the European leg of 2022's Shows of a Lost World Tour, the band would open and close their main set, The the same way with Alone. Its opening line, "This is the end of every song that we sing." And End Song, which finishes "Left Alone with Nothing," the end of every song, nothing. The new album follows this sequencing, a kind of duet, dust-to-dust musical palindrome that locks the album into its fate, exits and entrances blocked. Death and disillusion are hardly unusual Cure elements. But these eight songs have the same concentrated intensity as 1989's Disintegration, a record similarly preoccupied with broken dreams, ebbing potential, mortality. The record was a product of Smith's horror at turning 30, then an unimaginable milestone of decay. In 2024, it's inevitable that falling apart means something very different. "Before, I used to write about stuff that I thought I understood," said Smith in 2019. "Now I know I understand it." That year, Smith revealed that he had recently lost his father, his mother, and his older brother, Richard. The latter instrumental in introducing him to Jimi Hendrix and Captain Beefheart, and his companion in an earlier musical venture, the Crawley Goat Band. Richard lived in Poland for years. Harrowing SOALW song, "I Can Never Say Goodbye," was first played on October 22, 2022, at Krakow's Torin Arena. It's the song at the eye of the album's emotional storm, Smith singing, "Something wicked this way comes to steal away my brother's life." It joins a slim collection of Cure songs, directly and explicitly traceable to real events. 2021 single, "Cut Here," his guilt-crushed song about the associates Billy McIntyre, for example, or "Love Song," his wielding song for his wife Mary. "I wrote this song from a lot of different perspectives until I finally settled on a simple lyrical narrative of what happens on the night he died," explained Smith in a note sent to reviewers. "Performing it on stage has helped me to deal with my grief. I miss him." Mowgli have frequently supported The Cure and the band's Stuart Breathworth, a longtime fan, attending as many dates on their 2022 European tour as he could. "He saw the new songs take shape," he says, "becoming not just bogus glimpses into works in progress, but pillars of the set. I Can Never Say Goodbye is quite different," he says. "A lot of Cure songs are personal in quite an abstract way, but this is personal in a very direct way. It's really a beautiful song, and you can see that Robert finds it quite emotional to sing." Tolhurst, who has known Smith for 60 years, "It's like family, you know," understands this new directness through the context of their upbringing. "Our childhood was very strictly Catholic, and it encouraged you not to show anything. It's a lifetime's labor to get to that point where you feel you can. Now it's like, well, if I'm not going to say what I really feel about things now completely and transparently, when am I? Because it's going to be too bloody late soon. And this is where I'm going to have to stop so we have enough time for the classic album review, but I will finish this article about The Cure next week. And the classic album review this week is MTV Unplugged by Nirvana. Nirvana, MTV Unplugged in New York, 1994. When the extended Nirvana family of Kurt Cobain, Chris Novoselic, Dave Grohl, Pat Smear, cellist Laurie Goldston, and a couple of meat puppets walked into MTV's New York studios to make the album no one thought a grunge band ever could, an acoustic album, it was impossible to predict quite how emotional the document they would leave behind would be. Originally transmitted for MTV's Unplugged show, screenshots from the performance make up the artwork. The album hints more strongly than any of their previous three at the band Nirvana could have blossomed into. Only Come As You Are was indebted to their heavier past. For the most part, it was the slower original tracks that saw the light of day. The likes of Dumb, Polly, and Something in the Way. And here's a little bit of the song Dumb from Nirvana from their album MTV Unplugged in New York.
Come back and pretend the sun's gone, the heaven light, the day's done, I'm having fun, I think I'm dumb, maybe just happy, think I'm just happy, think I'm just happy. I'm just happy. My heart is broke. I have some blue. Help me heal. Mend it with you. We'll float around. Hang out on clouds. Then we'll come down. Have a hangover. Have a hangover.
An indulgent three tracks performed with and written by the Meat Puppets betrayed Cobain's desire to use his status to break respected friends' bands. Elsewhere, stunning Vaseline's and Bowie covers were thoughtfully executed. At points on the latter, Cobain plays Bowie's vocal line as a solo. Lead Belly's blues standard, which closed the proceedings, has lasted the test of time as an inspired and emotional exorcism and a chilling reminder of the great loss Kurt Cobain was to the musical world. All at once, bringing America's musical heritage bang up to date with a cracked, bitter voice. When he sighs, in a moment of silence, just before the climactic closing section, it seems the weight of the world is crushing him. That it eventually did make Unplugged, at times, a record dangerously close to the bone. And here's some of the song about a girl by Nirvana from the album MTV Unplugged in New York.
Good evening. This is off our first record. Most people don't own it.
Oh.
And unfortunately, once again, we're all out of time. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the December 2024 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to finish the article about The Cure and then an article about Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers in 1982 and a classic album review of NWA's Straight Out of Compton. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long. And keep rocking.